yeah, we want to do for our bonus, we want to have like compelling name to get people to tune in for the drama.
Yeah,
and we were thinking about saying, oh, if you want to talk about that, you got to meet me out front, and that'll be like behind the paywall.
Right. We're trying to kind of bite off what Doug Lane, I think, brilliantly did when he was in charge of the Zero Books YouTube, which is that like you play the straight man. You know, for the non-paying folks, but then you're like, if you want to hear the drama, if you want to hear us spill the tea, we're gonna take it to the parrot room. But that he called it the parrot room. We need
tell,
a name for
tell
us.
Tell me what you really think.
We're going on Front Street.
Front Street, that's good. Front Street.
Well, putting someone on Front Street is like dumping all their shit out into the open.
Okay.
So we're gonna workshop it. Maybe Front Street, but but this is a space. This is a space behind the paywall where maybe 1/10 of the people
behind the venue.
You were at the main show.
The bouncers have been slipped to 20. They're not coming back. No one to save you.
You were in the pit. Somebody like Alex Vitale looked at you funny.
Someone dissed your crew.
Yeah. You were picking up change and they caught an elbow and now they want to talk to you about abolition outside.
It's like the washing machine behind CBGB's.
But that is what this is a safe space for, is for lightly ribbing people that we may have mentioned in the main episode. So get ready for more of that goss.
Yeah. Here's me lightly ribbing someone. So, Jared, how did you become interested in Rikers?
Well, the issue kind of came to me. I got stuck there for a month, and I was really stunned by how close it was to New York City. And, you know, I flew in today through LaGuardia, and you're actually, like, looking at Rikers. There's a massive window. I took a photo of it a pedestrian, whatever, bench in front of it.
Oh, yeah. One time I was sailing up the East River, and I passed Rikers, and I took a picture and sent it to you, and I was like, hey, Jared, I'm passing your old place.
That was a good one, Andy.
Just so people don't get the wrong idea, when Andy's talking about sailing up the East River, he's not talking about some luxury yacht. He's talking about some, like, beat-up old sailboat.
Yeah.
Apparently, Krusty's now, instead of hopping trains, are just, like, buying... you know, $500 boats and fixing them up and living in a redacted location in New York City on the water.
It did not make it through the rest of the year.
But yeah, so I was really taken aback by how close Rikers was to New York. You know, you can hear the planes flying overhead. You can see Manhattan. That's actually a beautiful view depending on where you're housed. But it's also just so far removed. It's a paramilitary compound. Accessible only by one bridge that's controlled by DOC. And this, the paradox of this, you know, this containment, both in fixed physical space, right, away from the city, but also containment within the totality of New York City life, struck me as so profound. And I went on Amazon.com and typed in the history of Rikers Island. And I couldn't believe it. Nothing came up. And I just couldn't, I was taken aback that nobody had written about it, this topic in a serious, sustained way before. When you think about how many stupid fucking books there are, you know, nobody had taken this one on. And so I resolved to learn as much as I could about the history and just started publishing articles. And yeah, it just resulted in this book. But you would know, Andy, actually, when I was locked up there in EMTC, you actually came to visit.
Yeah, it's actually a really good experience to visit it. It's like a little microdose of like the horror that people have to, the bureaucratic nality, and I don't really have anything funny to say about it. It's like, it was a good experience because I got to see what that kind of institutionalization is like firsthand. But you know, I don't really remember anything. Maybe you've got like a funny story you're thinking of, but.
I don't think that there's really anything funny about it, except I guess since this is the episode no one listens to. I was subjected to regular strip searches where you had to show your asshole to the guards, and the guards were very masculine, performing men, big, muscly guys who would act cartoonishly appalled at the sight of genitals and anuses.
Uh-huh.
Although, given that they looked at hundreds of them every day, it must uh-huh. have been a very banal sight.
Yeah.
At this, akin to a plumber seeing a sink or something. This guard was commanding me to, you know, spread your ass so I can look at it and make sure there's no, like, I don't know, drugs sticking out or something. And then he said something that I didn't understand, and I interpreted it to mean spread it wider, but he had actually meant to say that you're done now. And he said, oh, stop. He was in physical pain at this spectacle.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't tell if it was sincere or not, but it made me appreciate a weapon that I never knew I had. But in all seriousness, the visiting process, I've gone through it on both sides, as a visitor and as a visited prisoner. And it is very dehumanizing on both ends. It takes all day. And if you think about actually where the majority of the prisoners come from who wind up at Rikers, neighborhoods like Flatbush, East New York, Brownsville, Bed-Stuy. If you're on public transit, it can take upwards of 2 hours just to get to the foot of the bridge. And then it can take anywhere up to 5 hours before you see the person that you're visiting. And so this is just a full day for working class people, just to see their loved one for, an hour or less. I made a zine called Visiting Day with two illustrator friends, Nate McDonough and Maude Pryor, who came and visited me at EMTC. The idea was we were going to document the visiting process from both sides. So I told the story of beginning with my name being shouted out into this massive chaotic dormitory with like 60 dudes yelling and screaming. And they told the story that began when they boarded the bus. And we tried to emphasize the symmetry of the process and just how thoroughly dehumanizing it is and how kind of massifying it is. You're very much treated like an object on an assembly line.
I've never been to prison. I've neither visited nor been incarcerated in prison. But I've been to jail a few times. And, you know, so we're talking about anything from 24 to 72 hours or so. Being processed, as they call it, going from being arrested, brought over in the paddy wagon to the precinct. You get to the precinct, you head over to famous central booking, depending on what borough you're in. And for people who, and maybe this is part of the what we're talking about with the direct action and collective action you see in prisons, you know, being treated as that object, being shuffled around, being even the process of somebody grabbing you, you know, by, and leading you to a place, it's very shocking. And it's no surprise that these sorts of institutions, these parts of society, breed an intense and institutional dehumanization. Because you certainly feel that when you're, even when you're locked up in a bullpen, when you're in central booking waiting to see a judge, and there's 35, 40 people in a bullpen meant to keep 10 or 15 people. You're served your little cheese sandwich with your little 2% milk. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll get an orange with that too.
I thought that was a pillow.
And you live like that for 3 days, just the process of being processed. You know, it shows like a maybe another your unreformable part of the system, which is to say, like, this dehumanization, this instrumentalization of people, this herding of people, turning people into cattle. It's a very visceral experience, I would say, having been, you know, through that a couple times. Nothing like Rikers, but just regular bog standard jail.
Well, one reform that benefited you a bit was you got vegan food when you were in there.
That was very interesting.
Even before the time of our vegan mayor, Eric Adams.
Yeah, I was being processed, and they said, do you have any dietary restrictions? And I was joking. I was like, yeah, I'm a strict vegetarian. And they were like, all right, cool, we got you. and I said, "What? Did that just happen?" And I had basically forgotten about it. And then a week later, I was summoned to this little office. It was about 5 by 5. It was about the size of a cell, where the chief dietitian of the building worked. And he said, "Yeah, I heard you're a vegan." And I said, "Yes, you heard correctly." And he gave me a special vegan diet card, which it entitled me to large helpings of beans and collard greens with every meal, portions of soy milk in the morning, which was very nice. Mm-hmm. I could bring it back and put it in my coffee. And it was generally, I was a little bit worried that the place was going to get gentrified, actually, that they were going to paint the walls lime green. Uh-huh. And soon enough, no one would be able to afford to go there.
How do you think that happened?
I should know the history. I know that there was a lot of push.
The missing chapter of captives.
Well, there was a push under Bloomberg. First, famously, Bloomberg eliminated smoking. And if there was ever going to be a 21st century prisoner riot that took over Rikers, it would have happened then. Which is not to say it can't happen. But Bloomberg initiated a whole lot of healthy eating programming in the kitchen, which is largely despised by the prisoners. There's now like a vegetarian day there, which the prisoners fucking hate. I actually found that even before I got my diet card, I was in a very powerful position because most prisoners would be willing to trade everything else on their tray just for the meat. So if I had like a chicken wing or something, I could trade that for like 2 pounds of beans and rice. And so, all things considered, the food wasn't so bad. I understand that that was a particular Bloomberg innovation. And then, of course, you had the commissary food, which is most of the prisoners eat very little of the food that they serve you in the cafeteria. It's really actually amazing, as one friend remarked. He's like, "Jesus Christ, you can't get away from capitalism anywhere. Like, I'm in jail and there's a fucking store, and I go shopping in the store in jail." And so that most prisoners subsist, the majority of their diet is this, combination of ramen noodles and, dehydrated chicken and all this shit that they all mix together into a plastic bag. It's called usually a bag meal or crackhead soup. And
how do they heat it up?
Usually with the hot water that is dispensed to make ramen noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a cool kind of social activity. I wrote about this in Hard Crackers, and David Campbell and I are working on a book, like an ethnography of this facility, and we talk a lot about it. He was there a lot longer than I was, so he knows way more about the recipes. But I was actually able to create a nice, workable vegan meal routine based largely off of mixing peanut butter and oatmeal into this like thick paste. That was a bit like eating Clif Bars all day.
Hell yeah.
And so it was actually like, I wouldn't recommend anybody ever going there, but I was pleasantly surprised at the ability that to keep a vegan diet, to eat reasonably healthy, and to not be emaciated when I got out.
And another way you were able to keep up your urban metropolitan lifestyle was you had a radio and you could listen to NPR. And I remember you told me about one program that you listened to one night, stuck with you.
Yeah, the first time I got a radio and I was so excited, and I turned on NPR, and it happened to be this like one of those like story hour segments where this woman was talking about her first New York apartment in Chelsea and how it was the size of a jail cell. And if she ever had to go to prison, she knew that she'd be okay because she had lived in this Chelsea apartment.
Right.
And I was just like, wow, this is just peak NPR.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, the radios do, they're very important there, because it's like, it's a way that you can transport yourself out of this very chaotic space.
Yeah, because you can't listen to podcasts, so.
Yeah, you can't even sign up to the Patreon for a show like this, which you all should do. But so where I was, it was the Facility for Sentenced Men, EMTC. Just to be clear, it's widely known as the calmest facility on the island, so I'm not flexing like I was in like the real nasty part of Rikers. But it's nonetheless a place where you can find yourself in a dormitory filled with upwards of 60 or 70 guys. People coming off the streets, you know, people with mental health issues, freaking out, all kinds of conflicts. And the radio is a good way to kind of transport yourself out of that setting.
I was going to tell a story about being in law. I feel it's very trivial for me to tell a story, though, because I feel like the difference between jail and prison is pretty serious. You don't think so?
No. It's actually funny. All the guys that I met who had been in state prison were like, bro, this isn't prison. Like, this is nothing. This is bullshit. This is pussy shit. And then I met this Russian dude who had been to prison in Russia, and he was like, American prison is not prison. And I imagine there was like an extraterrestrial observer watching us from space and be like, Earth prison is nothing, you know.
Yeah, didn't he have some story about going to see the dentist in the Russian prison?
What about how the cops extracted his teeth one by one?
Yeah.
When they were interrogating him?
Yeah.
And he removed two sets of complete dentures to demonstrate that.
I mean, here's a question, and this isn't directly related to Rikers, but I'm thinking about it in light of your research in the book. Like Varg Varkanis, or whatever the fuck his name is, the Burzum guy, went to like sweet Swedish prison. You know, the guy went to like beautiful, have your own room, eat like bespoke meals. Like, basically, there might as well have been antlers hanging on the wall. He's playing like Xbox and shit like that. Is the reason why European prisons, not Russian specifically, but let's say Northern European prisons are more humane, is not just their political history, but the lack of autonomy of like prison guard unions and like the lack of a backlash? Like, why is it that there are like sweet prisons for like black metal guys to go to after they murder their friends over there and not over here?
I'm not a political economist, but my understanding of Northern Europe in general is that they're very highly protected populations of the world's most privileged working people living off the surplus value of the entire planet. And they guard their borders zealously. They have a kind of social contract based on what we might call Keynesianism that is premised on a very homogeneous population.
So what you're saying is we have to build that in the United States if we're going to do prison reform. We're going to have to build like a exclusionary social democracy that lives imperialistically off the exploited wage labor. We also have to build, I guess, a stronger labor aristocracy. We have to basically like read Settlers and be like, that was good, actually.
Yeah, we tried to just make a black metal movement in the United States, seeing if that would do it, and it hasn't worked.
It's almost like, it's like a form of socialism, but it's like a national form of socialism. Oh, yeah. And I think that there's actually still one way that Bernie can still win. So we might be able to.
I'm now imagining in my head Law and Order Bernie. 1% of all the workers commit 99% of all the crimes. This has to end. We have to stop the hoarding of all of the criminal behavior of this one working class percentage. We have to lock them up. We got to put them away. For too long have we suffered the tyranny of the lumpen proletariat. We must discipline them in wage labor. We must ensure that they live upstanding lives. And if they don't, I'm telling you, all of you people today, we will put them away for life. Three strikes is too many. Under a Bernie Sanders presidency, half the working class will be locked up if we have to do it.
but the other half will live like a king. A chicken in every pot. A cup of noodles in every home. This is my promise to you as law and order, Bernie Sanders.
That's a really good impression.
If you're in the Brooklyn DSA and you just tuned in, don't get excited. That was actually a bit. That is not the next candidate that you will be supporting for political office.
Wow, thanks for the compliment, Andy. I feel like if Michael Brooks was alive, I would to think that he would like Law and Order Bernie Sanders.
Oh, he would love it.
Yeah. R.I.P. Michael. Yeah, we're good with that? What was that, 30 minutes? Me and my friend Johnny.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, fuck it.
Were you locked?
Yeah, there was a, shall we say, a high-profile student occupation back in the halcyon days of when I didn't yet drop out of college, where some friends of ours, Andy's and myself, ended up getting arrested, ended up getting processed, ended up getting sent away. But in the course of this action, it became clear to us within 7 to 8 hours of when we actually got arrested that we were going down big time, that the cops had us surrounded and that they were going to take us. So one of the fellow demonstrators at this protest had brought a giant bottle of plastic Popov vodka. Another one of our friends had a prescription for anti-anxiety medication. Suffice it to say, by the time the officers of the law arrived, we were in quite a state.
I was outside, and I always wondered why they carried you guys out. I thought you were engaging in civil disobedience, but this sheds a lot more light on that.
That was not resistance you saw there, my friend. That was old-fashioned, I don't know what, obliteration, annihilation of oneself, knowing the impending disaster about to fall upon you and buffeting yourselves against the storms of the dehumanization of the institution. So we end up in the paddy wagon where we began to sing Irish drinking songs and IRA songs, too. That's a fortunate thing about having... getting locked up with people with a strong historical memory of past struggles is that you could pretend for a second to be Bobby Sands or some bullshit like that, where you're just going to, end up in jail for 72 hours. But at any rate, by the time we made it.
Bobby Sands.
He might not have died if he had had Xanax to dull the. Anyways.
He would eat one thing.
Hunger strike except Xanax. Oof, okay. Good thing we're behind a paywall.
Is that paywall again?
Not high enough.
My family in the old country.
We're not naming any names here, all right? There's no Ulster unionists, at least, listen to the paywall stuff, as far as I know. But, by the time we got in and, they brought us through the precinct and into central booking, which is like the large collecting area where all the different precincts bring people. It's where you wait to eventually see a judge. Again, it takes allegedly 24 hours, but it's more like 2-3 days or whatever. By the time we got there, we were absolutely toasted. And to be honest, we were having quite a fine time for the next 6 to 7 hours before the fucking hangover kicked in. But we were mixed up in general population, my friend Johnny and I. Some of the people we were with were in there, but it was a lot of just people, random things, I don't know, drunken, disorderly, or whatever people get into. And we saw the corrections officers, total assholes. We saw them getting ready to take a break. And we were eating those shitty fucking cheese sandwiches for all the meals. And the corrections officer came by and they had one of those big white boxes, the Entenmann's pound cake. And they were bringing it to the corrections officer desk to share it amongst themselves. My friend Johnny is in the cell across.
Something
from
you
me.
Wouldn't eat under any circumstances.
Absolutely
normally.
Absolutely not, no. My friend Johnny.
But you were in jail for 7 hours and you needed it.
And we were like coming down now, so we were feeling a little rowdy. My friend Johnny's in the cell on the other side and his eyes get big and he's like, they got fucking pound cake. And I was like, what?
pound cake. And then one of the guys behind us, some random dude's like, yo, did you guys say fucking pound cake? Like, yeah, man. CEOs are walking around in here with fucking pound cake. The guy behind us, yo, I want some fucking pound cake. And I'm damn straight. I want some fucking pound cake. And everyone starts murmuring pound cake up and down through all the cells or whatever. And a long story short is eventually there was a chant that got going, which was pound cake. What do we want, pound cake? When do we want it now? And oh boy, if you want to piss off some corrections officers, get a chant going about Entenmann's pound cake. And they will. They will rattle your cage a little bit. So that was the funnest time I ever spent in jail. It was good. I mean, it was miserable with the hangover for the next like day and a half or so. But good times can be had. Maybe that was like my little piece of collective action in jail, or at least as like a jail tourist, as somebody passing through for a very short mm-hmm. amount of time. Got to dunk on ourselves a little bit, right?
Yeah, and Andy, I remember when you and our friend Tans visited me, you know, I had just been thinking so much about the relationship between Rikers Island and the broader New York City social fabric. And, you know, I talk about this in the introduction to the book, how it's really just like a central part of the city and how the city's reproduced. That when you showed up, and actually they, because Tans had a facial piercing that she couldn't remove, they stuck you in the bad boys cage, the cage designed for the offenders, the offenders among the visitors who had broken the law before, right? And so there's no contact, had to shout through these holes drilled into some glass, couldn't hear a fucking word, basically. But you asked me if I wanted to hear news from the outside world. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that I didn't understand the question. Because I felt I'm in the epicenter of New York City right now. I mean, do you want some news from the center of the world? Mm-hmm. You know? And that's
plus you could listen to NPR.
Well, yeah, plus I had all the Terry Gross
news source you can have.
Yeah, I could imagine Terry was interviewing me all day. Like, Jared, I noticed that everybody else has an extra pair of flip-flops, and they bring them into the toilet, and they put the flip-flops on the toilet seat and sit on those. Now, I noticed that you didn't do that. Could you say a little bit about why? Oh, yeah, well, Terry, you see, if everybody else is sitting on the flip-flops when they sit on the toilet seat, that actually means that I don't have to.
Now, I would have a driveway moment with that. Jared Shanahan with Terry Gross doing prison talk. Mm-hmm. Man, they got to give you a show.
I know Terry's pretty popular in there. Like, everyone's got their pinup of Terry Gross and different poses.
If you dishonor TG, better watch out.
All right.
Cool, man. That was great. Yeah.
Staten Island, Chewin' Dean, Five Boroughs.